going to be better defined than their continuum counterparts. And if people are interested and if there's time, I'll give you an indication of, in the right limit, what answer you get. And it turns out that you can get the causal propagator for the Klein-Gordon equation if you look at it in the right way. Okay, so I'll begin by giving you the definition of a causal set, just in case there's anyone here who doesn't know. And so this is a set, a causal set is a pair. It's a set C and a partial order relation called precedes, such that every point precedes itself, and it's transitive. And it's anti-symmetric. So that means that if x precedes y and y precedes x, then x and y are the same point. So if I stopped here, I'd just be describing the causal structure of a manifold spacetime, of causal manifold spacetime. But a causal set is a discrete model for spacetime. And this discreteness comes in this fourth part that says that the causal set is locally finite. So it says that all of these causal intervals have a cardinality that is finite. And that's where the big difference to the continuum comes in. Because you can imagine Minkowski spacetime, and so this causal precedes relation is to be interpreted by saying that x precedes y if x is to the causal past of y. So in Minkowski spacetime, you have your causal intervals, but each causal interval contains infinitely many points. Okay, so the causal set is a model for spacetime in which we're going away from the continuum, and there's a number of motivations for this. The singularities that occur within black holes and the divergences in quantum field theory, there's some reasons that you might be suspicious that the continuum has some problems.
So that is gauge theory. You have the structure. You want to have the structure. That is gauge theory, which is a discrete structure. This is what you have.
So this is a Lorentzian discrete structure. Yeah. My understanding is that in lattice gauge theory, if you work with a hypercubic lattice, you're either working with it being Euclidean, or you're working with it being non-relativistic. That's a preferred time direction.
So you can always rotate Minkowski spacetime into Euclidean given the right conditions.
Yeah, I mean, but this is a more sort of direct approach. You can imagine your causal set is like a random lattice in Lorentzian spacetime. So you don't need to Euclideanize.
Yeah, but as far as I know, the theorems that guarantee the weak rotation to work in flat space field theories don't work in quantum. They don't work in the context of gravity.
No, in spite of what Professor Hawking says. Professor Hawking.
Well, Professor Hawking says you don't have to do it. You're always in the Euclidean.
Yeah.
You just feel that you're in the line.
I don't feel I'm sitting in your
Okay, so associated with any causal set, there's a few definitions that I'll give you now. So a chain is a sequence of points which is totally ordered. So we have x1 precedes x2 precedes x3. And we say that xi are all distinct. There's no x1 to x1 to x2. And a link is any relation x precedes y with no z such that x precedes z precedes y. So there's no z causally between x and y. And we'll write this as x is linked to y. Okay. So a path is the first definition is any chain It's any chain made of links. So I'll give you an example now, which might help to clarify these ideas. So, just from our definition of our causal set over there, we can form a mental picture of it by drawing it with as a graph. So we draw the elements of the set C as points in the plane, and we have a directed arrow from one to another if the points are related. So here's an example. Okay, so in this example, V1 is related to V3, but it is not linked because V2 is causally between V1 and V3. So we have that V1 is linked to V2, but not to V3 or V4. And a chain in this case might be V1 to V3. V4. And a path might be V1 to V2 to V3 to V4. Okay, so there's another way to think about these causal sets, and that's in terms of their adjacent symmetries. So there's two types. So there's the transitively complete, transitively closed matrix with entry 1 if VI precedes VJ, and 0 if otherwise. Okay. And then there's the transitively reduced matrix, where it's 1 if VI is linked to Vj. And we're also going to impose that Vi is not equal to Vj, so that these matrices are zero on the main diagonal. So Aii is zero. Okay. So in this example, Ac is given by 1.
Z not equal to x over 1.
Yeah, I mean, So, I'm gonna change my notation very badly now. So now, x exceeds y. How about that? So then that means that these points are all distinct, and that z is not equal to x or y.
Sorry?
Bring
your simultaneity of events.
Identity. Very strong
simultaneity. Well,
at the same time, at the same event.
Well, choosing this this relation, this is most in keeping with the causal relation on a Lorentzian manifold, because there the relation is that there is a future-directed causal curve from x to y. And so that means that x precedes x. It's
it's a convention again. People divide a relation that they call J plus between x and y, and that's what Stephen is referring to. And the convention is that if x equals y, then y is in J plus as the so-called causal relation.
Yeah. Okay. So now I will talk a little bit about path integrals. So in the continuum, the idea is we want to define how particles might propagate. And in quantum mechanics, this is described by a propagator, which is a function of two space-time points, and it gives you the quantum mechanical amplitude that the particle goes between the two points. And so in quantum field theory, there's a lot of different ways that people picture it. And we'll be viewing it as particles moving around according to these propagation laws. And in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, the propagator can be computed by doing a path integral over all trajectories from x to y. And when you do that, you assign an amplitude for each trajectory, and then you add them all up. And that gives you the propagator. So we have two choices. We have to decide which trajectories we're going to use and what amplitudes we're going to assign to each one. So, so the possible trajectories in our causal set so we have all chains or all paths. And these are the two most natural choices, I think. Now the amplitudes. So we're going to find two basic amplitudes for what this particle might do. So we're going to have A as the amplitude for a hop, and B is the amplitude for a stop. So what do I mean by these? I mean, on our causal set, we can imagine we have a particle, and we're asking what trajectories does it do. So it might go from V1 to V2, and then from V2 to V4. So that would be one hop from V1 to V2, and then one stop at V2, and then one hop from V2 to V4. And the total amplitude for the whole trajectory, whether it's a chain or a path, is just the product of the amplitudes for each hop and each stop. So for a chain or a path of length n, so this length means there's n relations involved, the amplitude is a to the n, b to the n minus 1. So there's n hops and n minus 1 stops. And so our task is now to sum these up over all possible trajectories from x to y to do the path integral. But really, in this case, it's path sum. So how do we do that? That at first sight, it seems quite a difficult thing to do. But we can do this by, so to sum over chains, we define a matrix, which is just A times the adjacency matrix, the causal matrix, not the one made of links. And to sum over paths, we have a similar idea. So now the question is, how do we sum these up? And it turns out that so if we our propagator is going to be a matrix, and it's given by this by a geometric sum. So the first term is all one hop trajectory, and then all two hop ones. Okay, so each term in this sum is the total contribution to the propagator from all trajectories of a particular length. So, for example, b squared j. So this is only non-zero when I precedes x. If, say we're summing over chains. So this is non-zero when I precedes x and x precedes j. And in that case, we get a contribution of a squared. So this adds up a squared b for all the chains of length 2. So in a similar way, we add them all up and we get this geometric series, which we can express as this matrix inverse. And so the resulting matrix K can be interpreted as this propagator. So in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, this propagator would be written non-relativistic quantum mechanics would be written like this. And this would say that the particle starts at xi at time ti and ends up at xj at time tj. Yep.
Propagators is a Green's function. So we have a differential equation using a second order differential equation. So how do you
interpret that? So that's certainly true. In the continuum, the propagators that we'll be interested in are propagators for the Klein-Gordon equation. And in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, they're Green's functions for the Schrodinger equation. And Feynman showed that you could calculate this Green's function by doing this path integral. So what we're doing is we're taking the idea of the path integral onto causal sets where the idea of differential equations doesn't make too much sense. But what I'm about to show you is that we can match this up with the continuum propagator, which we obtain as a Green's function for the Klein-Gordon equation.
That's the
crux of the matter. That's the crux of the matter, yeah. So far, it's been completely general. We haven't specified what A and B are. We've just presented the scheme.
You can actually just raise the board. There's another one.
Huh?
So it's indiscriminate here. It seems
continuous. So in the causal set approach, space and time, space-time is discrete. Okay. So these individual points can be pictured like little space-time events, and there's only finitely many of them in any finite volume. Okay, so I'll now talk about propagators for the Klein-Gordon equation. So these are, as I said, these are Green's functions. So they satisfy this equation, this defining equation. And we can solve this. So we're going to be dealing with Minkowski spacetime, because that's where a lot of particle physics is done, and it's got a nice simple causal structure. So we've got the best of both worlds, really. So we can solve this by performing a Fourier transform. And the Fourier transformed propagator comes out as so I should say that the Dahlenbergian that I'm using here is with this signature. Okay, so the problem comes when we try to get the position space representation for this propagator. The integrand in the Fourier transform version has poles in the p nor is the square root of p squared minus m squared. So we need a prescription for how to avoid these poles. And there's a number of choices, but we're going to avoid them by adding a small imaginary part to the p naught component. So in essence, we're avoiding them by changing the contour slightly. And this choice of how to avoid the poles gives you the causal retarded propagator. So, so with this choice, our propagator becomes So this looks like a bit of a mess. And people prefer the Fourier transform version because it looks quite simple. But I'll now just show you what the, you can explicitly work out this integral. And I'll show you what you get.
Probably that far, you mean in D? This is in general.
Oh, sorry. Yes, sorry. Okay. So in 1 + 1 dimensions. Okay, so in 1 + 1 dimensions, this this propagator is given by a Bessel's function on the future light cone, inside the future light cone, and it's zero everywhere else, which is why it's called the causal propagator. And in 3 + 1. We have a fairly similar expression. So this is this now has a delta function on the future light cone, and there's a Bessel's function inside. So looking at these, you kind of think, well, I can sympathize with the people who prefer the Fourier transform version. The Fourier transform version does look a lot simpler. But then it turns out that maybe these seemingly complicated expressions are sitting on top of actually quite a simple way to get them. And the simple way to get them comes from this Pfaffenschuh expression. So at the moment, this board is all about the causal set. It's all discrete. It's all on the causal set. And this board is all on Minkowski spacetime. So we need, if we want to be able to compare things, we need to make sure that our causal set is like Minkowski spacetime in some sense.
One of the crucial things in finite field theory about causality is that the commutation of two field operators equals times equals zero space absence.
Right.
This comes from what's called the delta. Delta,
capital delta. Yes.
So what happens here? This is the trademark of causality in quantum.
Yeah, that's right. So, so as I mentioned before, the approach we're taking is not that we have fields on our causal set, and we have field operators. But the approach instead is this propagator approach, which was pioneered by Feynman back in the day. So as such, there is no mention of these field operators, and so we're not sure what it might mean to have field operators commuting or not commuting. We don't have field operators on our causal set yet. Well, as I said, there's these different ways to look at it. There's this view where you have the field operators and you have equations of motion. Or there's this path integral view where you're describing the motion of these particles and you involve these propagators. And out of the two views, the one that involves these differential equations of motion doesn't seem best suited to the discrete space-time of the causal set.
Because in quantum field theory, if you take the particle, you can define the probability average for measure. You use that
So this talk is only going to go up to defining these propagators and showing that you get the continuum propagators. But obviously, the next step beyond that is to use the propagators for something. And the natural place to use them is to draw out all Feynman diagrams and associate the legs of the Feynman diagrams with the appropriate propagators. So I've been looking at this, and it seems as though this deal where you have your matrix geometric series and you have your matrix multiplication summing over all possible alternatives extends quite nicely to having Feynman diagrams. So I haven't developed it in any sense yet, but it seems like there's room there to have a natural encoding of these Feynman diagrams. To describe scattering of these particles. Yeah.
And you get physics.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is like a building block towards that. Okay. So So we're interested in comparing these two results. We have the propagator in position space in Minkowski spacetime, and we have the propagator on our causal set. And up till now, we haven't specified what these A and these B are. So hopefully, by trying to match the two expressions, we can determine A and B. Now, what on earth does that mean, match the two expressions? Because we have our discrete causal set over here, and we have our continuous Minkowski spacetime over here. How are we going to compare the two things? So we do that by ensuring that our causal set is like Minkowski spacetime. And we do that by performing a sprinkling, by generating a causal set from Minkowski spacetime. So very roughly, we have a manifold, Lorentzian manifold, and we place points down into this manifold at random according to a Poisson process. So the probability of getting n points in a volume V is given by this formula. And once we've laid down our points, we can deduce a causal set by looking at the causal relations in the manifold. Okay. And this gives us our causal set. But because we place the points down at random, the particular causal set we get from the same manifold will be different each time. And so because it will be different each time, anything we calculate on that particular causal set isn't really going to mean much. What we'll be interested in is the average of things we calculate over all causal sets generated by this process. So we're interested in the expected number. So, for example, we're interested in the expected number of chains of length n. So I should first say that the expected number of points in a volume V is just given by this constant rho, which is the sprinkling density times the volume. So say we're interested in the expected number of chains of length n. So this is given by so we integrate over all possible intermediate positions. And we have a function where this function is So the point is that we can explicitly do this. We can analytically calculate the expected number of length 10 chains from a sprinkling into Minkowski spacetime. And so the expected number of things adds up. So we can use this, along with our expression above, to find the expected value for this propagator that sums over chains.
Since you have an integral, this implies you have a continuum.
Yeah. So we have our continuum manifold, and we're using it to generate a causal set.
The causal set is complete.
Yes. So. So there's this process. We have our continuum manifold, and we fix a sprinkling density. And with that density, we put down a discrete set of points into our continuum manifold, so that the expected number of points in any particular volume is equal to the density times the continuum volume. So, you know, schematically, it's like this. We have our manifold here. We randomly assign points into it. And then we say we now have a causal set in which the elements of our set are the sprinkled points. And the causal relation is defined using the manifold as a crutch. So the causal relation is induced from the manifold.
Since the crucial part of this is that you have a continuum manifold. So why do you already have a manifold, so you may as well use it.
No. So
I'm getting that.
So ultimately, crash, okay. so in the big scheme of things, yeah, down the line, we're expecting that we'll be able to get some kind of causal set dynamics such that on large scales we'll grow a causal set and it will look like a Lorentzian manifold. And therefore, the manifold, we won't need it at all. But we don't have that yet. We have to use the manifold as a crutch. If we're interested, so this scheme that I had up here where you have your K matrix, this is defined solely in terms of the causal set. So that's fine. But if it's just in terms of the causal set itself, we can't compare it with things we already know in the continuum.
Integrate.
Yeah, we can't integrate, can't differentiate, can't do much.
We can sum.
All right. So we're trying to compare it. Yeah, so these integrals that you mentioned, they're in terms of the Minkowski space. They're on Minkowski space.
Then you have to ask, if you had a causal set as the fundamental thing, and you had, like you said, some sort of propagator, and that was folded into some Feynman diagrams, and you could something like an S matrix, you have to ask whether or not you get out results consistent with what we know in the Minkowski space. So that's what this is doing. Mm-hmm. So this is limiting yourself to the class of causal sets which are well approximated by Minkowski space.
Yeah, per se, when you do, the problem with discrete physics is that you have to take continuum in, and that is where a lot of the troubles lie. Trying to get a continuum limit, which is Poincaré invariant.
So this is built on automatically to Poincaré invariant. This is automatically Poincaré invariant. That's the point.
Not in the continuum limit.
It's already Poincaré invariant in effect, even without the continuum limit. But it's certainly in the continuum limit.
So because we placed our points down randomly, there's no preferred frame. If you had some diamond lattice, then that chooses a frame. But if we're pointing our points down randomly, and then we say, oh, well, we're going to boost our manifold points, then it still looks as random before and after the boost.
You see, analog is again this has always been a contention, issue of contention. I mean, you take the lattice space into zero, do you get full Poincaré invariance? This causes problems like doubling of frames and stuff like that. It's highly non-trivial.
Right. One of the appeals of the causal set approach is that it's a discrete approach in which it is Lorentz invariant.
In the lattice case, you could at least, in principle, solve the problems of taking continuum limit if you could find a fixed point of lattice transformation, and you essentially engineer a perfect action. So you can do that in principle, maybe do something in principle here.
I always hate that word in principle.
But I think the point that maybe getting was in the lattice, by putting down the lattice, the rectangular lattice, you're breaking the Lorentz invariance, or in that case, the rotational invariance.
Yeah, you break it.
But this is not, that's somehow the whole point. This is not breaking the invariance.
Why not?
It's a kind of discreteness that doesn't break the invariance. It's what Stephen said. It's the randomness. You might have noticed many years ago, T.D. Lee suggested what he called a random lattice to overcome this problem. But the way he used it, he reintroduced the kind of frame, unfortunately. But this observation, the starting observation is the same thing, which is that the random sprinkling of points into Minkowski space is what people call mathematically a Poisson process. That process itself is fully Poincaré invariant. So a random lattice, unlike a regular lattice, doesn't break the symmetry. And so if you go far enough if you don't introduce any extra structure which would break the symmetry, and you can formulate a theory on that lattice, then it's like a gauge invariance. It's like preserving gauge invariance on the lattice. In this case, you preserve Poincaré invariance.
So why don't people use random lattices to do that calculation? This is an industry.
Maybe they could use this.
There's a reason why they don't do that.
One reason, well,
for the last 25, 30 years.
What is it? It just makes, why, what is it?
Because life gets very difficult. In physics, you can always do something in principle, but when you actually come down to doing the calculation, principles don't help you. In principle, it doesn't help. So
I've tried to avoid using the word in principle, but for example, this K propagator matrix, this K propagator matrix here, it's not hard to compute it. You just do one matrix inverse, and you have this sum over all the paths and all the chains for all the pairs of points in your causal set. So computationally, it's not difficult. The question is, can you, and the numbers you get out, are they interesting? Are they interesting? Are they like the continuum numbers? Right. So I'm about to show you that with the right A and B choice, they are. So we have this expression for the expected number of N length chains. So now we're defining the expected value of this sum over chains. We just do it. We say we weight each one by the appropriate weight, and then we have a number which gives you the expected number of these n length chains. And we sum this up over all length chains. So this satisfies an integral equation. Which at first sight looks a bit of a mess, but if we could solve it, we can explicitly get an analytic expression for the expected value of this propagator that was worked out on the causal set, but then we average that over all causal sets, to see, generated by this sprinkling, to see whether it gives a value that's anywhere close to the continuum propagated here. So to make progress in solving this, we do a Fourier transform. And these, this expression is a convolution, so it becomes a product. And then once that's a product, we can rearrange it, and we get that the Fourier transform version can be expressed solely in terms of the Fourier transform of this function, which is 1 if x precedes y and 0 if otherwise. So, I'm going to explicitly show you how the calculation works in 1 plus 1 dimensions, and then I'll just tell you how it works in 3 plus 1. So, in 1 plus 1, we can find out what the Fourier transform of nu is by using this line on the board. So we notice that if we set m is 0 in this function, then we get that k of 0 is just a half if x precedes y and 0 otherwise. So this is Green's function just for the D'Alembertian operator, because we've set m as 0. And so it's so the bit that I missed out disappears. So we set m as 0, and we see. Okay. So in 1 plus 1, this function is 2 times k of 0. So in particular, its Fourier transform is minus 2 over okay. So we can substitute this in. We can substitute this expression into this one. And where should I do this? Okay, so we get that Kc is minus 2a rearranging this. So we now have the Fourier transformed version of the expected number of expected value of this propagator when we do a sprinkling into Minkowski spacetime, into two-dimensional Minkowski spacetime. And we can now equate this with the Fourier transform of the propagator in 1 plus 1 to figure out what A and B are. So we're equating this expression with this expression, and we find that A is a half, B is minus m squared over root. Okay, so now So what have we found? We've found that if our causal set is generated by a sprinkling into two-dimensional Minkowski spacetime, so we've randomly selected our points from two-dimensional Minkowski spacetime, and we've used that to induce a causal order to make our causal set. Now, if we have the amplitude for a hop to be a half, and the amplitude for a stop to be minus m squared over rho, where m is the mass of the particle, then just the sort of combinatorics of how many chains there are connecting different points automatically means that the expected value, if we sum this amplitude over all the chains, is the continuum causal propagate. Now, this is pretty nice. It's now you can do the same thing for summing over paths, and it turns out that's what you need to do in 3+1 dimensions. But I'm not going to go into the details of that. But I'll tell you what your A and B are. So in 3+1, summing over paths. So now A is and then in 3+1, you have to take this sprinkling density to infinity. You have to do the continuum limit to get the answer exactly right. But what we learn from this is that if we use these amplitudes, then for high density sprinkling, the sum over paths will be approximately given by this continuum expression. Okay, so I've shown you the 1+1 case in quite a bit of detail, but I'd like to show you the simulation. So you can actually do this. You can do a sprinkling on a computer. You can randomly select your points, and you can do this matrix inverse. And for that particular causal set, you can work out what the propagator is. And I brought along some pictures for a particular simulation that I did, which I would like to show you on this display. Okay, so what we have here is the white wavy line is this Bessel function. So this is in 1+1 dimensions. And the proper time between the points is along the bottom, and the value of this propagator. So what we're plotting here is this function. Now, we fixed our sprinkling density. So in the top one, it's 150 points per unit volume. And then we explicitly work it out. We do this geometric sum of all over all the chains. And we get a value. So this is just for one run. And the answers we get are dotted around. Yeah. But then we can increase the sprinkling density. So in the lower one, we have
all those dots are just individual elements of the causal set in a single run.
Yeah, a single run. Mm-hmm. So we can increase it. So for 300, the dots come down. And they get a bit closer to the line. Then we can increase it still. And so the progression as the density increases, it tends to the expected value. So that's telling us that the fluctuations because not only are we interested that the expected value is the right continuum answer, but we also want the fluctuations to decrease as we take larger and larger sprinkling densities. And so, although this is by no means a proof, this is suggestive that the fluctuations decrease as we increase the density. So that's good news. I haven't been able to get similar graphs for 3 plus 1, where we sum over paths. And that's, I suspect, mainly because my simulations are too small. Because for the sum over paths, we have to take the row going to infinity limit to get the precise continuum expression. And so the kind of densities that I can simulate are nowhere near large enough. That's part of the reason I'm here, to find out how to do higher sprinkling densities. Okay, so as a sort of final remark, I'd like to hear what people have to say about the following observation. So when we had this Klein-Gordon Green's function, we had poles in the integrand, and we avoided them a certain way. And that gave us this causal Green's function, this causal propagator. But there's another choice of how to avoid these poles, and that gives you the Feynman propagator. And the Feynman propagator is what people use in quantum field theory. That is the propagator you assign to these legs of your Feynman diagrams. So the question is, can we get away with just having the causal propagator? And so I'm not sure if we can, but there's two things I would like to show you which suggest that we might be able to. So there's one is a footnote in a paper by Feynman. Hope you can all read that. So it has often been noted that the one electron theory, which is this one where you have this, you avoid the poles in the same way we have avoided them here, apparently gives the same matrix elements for this process as does the Hall theory, which you use this Feynman property. The problem is one of interpretation, and especially a way that will also give correct results for other processes, for example, self-energy.
What is this process?
So this is where you have an electron going through a potential and scattering and possibly going backwards in time. Okay. And then there's also just a quote from a paper by Schwinger, in which he's introducing the whole formalism. And he says, he defines this thing, and he says, so G is a Green's function for the Dirac field. We shall not discuss the particular Green's function this is, as specified by the associated boundary conditions, since no ambiguity enters if actual pair creation in the vacuum does not occur, which we shall expressly assume. So although the total number of words in these two quotes is maybe about 20 or 30, this is, I hope, suggestive that you can get away with using the causal propagator, and that for certain processes, it will give you the same answers as if you used the Feynman propagator. But if anyone knows any more about these things, I'd be very interested to hear what their opinions of that are. And I will stop there. Thanks for listening. Any questions?
I have any thoughts on the two questions. But for making these calculations, so when you should fix the causal relation, translational invariance in this stochastic process, no? How it was fixed?
Oh, having no translation invariance? So
you have generated these points
stochastic. Yes, the bit I wrapped up. Yeah.
We're thinking that this should be done in a translational, partially translational invariant way in order to get this result. No?
So it's done, we place our points down randomly, yeah? stochastically. And it's that randomness that is enough to give us our Poincaré invariance. So if we examine a section of our manifold where we've placed our points down, there'll be some points here, some points there, and it will be random. If we then translate that across and we examine that, that will also be random. And it will be statistically the same.
For example, if you fix, you locally fix one causal relation with a conus, by conus, stretch, and in another point, all it should not appear this result. For example, saying that the causal relation is not given by the same right conus or similar in a stochastic way in one point in another.
I see. So when we're generating our causal set by a sprinkling, we use the light cones in the manifold. We use those to. Yeah, we're using the full light cone of the manifold to define the causal relation. Yeah.
If you avoid introducing this manifold. Is there a limit which gives you that answer? That would be a truly discrete continuum.
So you fix your A and your B. So we have our A and our B here. And we could apply this rule to any causal set. We generate some causal set. And
it's discrete volume.
Yeah, so you interpret.
That's what it is.
But there's no V in the rule. The rule just is a sum over chains or a sum over paths and the causal set.
No, but when he introduces the integral over the news, it's a continuum. And he's using that to get the Fourier transform.
Well, that was only chosen, that was done to choose the coefficients A and B. That was just a ladder to be thrown away, as people say. So in the end, you just have an expression that makes sense on the causal set. It just has A and B, and it has a sum over paths or a sum over links. And the result is what you might call a propagator in the causal set.
Yeah, we.
That's completely well defined independently of any reference to any manifold.
But if you start with a discrete structure, the O and the V are discrete, then you say the V is a continuum. That's what gives you.
No, I think the problem you're having is the difference between, so you have a causal set, and that's whatever it is, it might look completely different to a manifold.
Yes.
And then you have a sprinkled causal set. So this is still a causal set, still satisfies the four rules. But we've generated it a certain way.
Yeah.
And the way we've generated it is by having the continuum. We've had our continuum manifold.
So you've got the answer that you wanted to see.
So the answer we're trying to get, right? A long-term causal set program is to get manifold-like causal sets just in terms of the causal set itself. But that's not the answer we're trying to get here in this talk.
It's not.
No. What we're trying to do here is trying to come up with a scheme on the causal set itself which agrees with the continuum. So somewhere in that comparison, we have to bring together the discreteness and the continuum. And that happens when we generate our causal set by doing a sprinkling. So we brought the continuum in, but that's in no way essential to our scheme. That's just there so we can compare our scheme to the continuum.
Yeah, because once you have your V as a continuum, and so it should be to for being sort of one half of being the minus x squared.
Yeah, so once you have these, right, you can forget the continuum. And you can say these are our values. We're going to have A as this and B as that. And in the case in which your causal set is like the continuum, the answers you get on the causal set are like the answers you get on the continuum. But if it's not like the continuum, you still get answers. It's just you have nothing to compare them with because you don't have the continuum. So the continuum has only been introduced as a comparison.
The other thing is you construct the S matrix and you use to find the property.
Right.
So the answer to your question is no.
Right, so these quotes that I put up.
No. Just take a standard textbook and want to fill through and construct the S matrix.
Yeah, so. Right. So, what I'm trying to find out is maybe there's another approach that gives you the same matrix elements, the same amplitudes and all this, but uses the causal propagator instead.
You have to be able to define the propagator elements. Maybe you can.
Well, that's another option, isn't it? I don't know.
I've done this. Because the final propagator is constructed from all the Green's functions.
Yeah.
Retired in the Rance Green's functions, you use them, the delta function. And the box of the delta function is the capital delta, is the little delta, correct? So
the problem is that capital delta is some combination of the retarded and advanced Green's function. But the Feynman propagator is not some combination of the retarded and advanced Green's functions. And those are the ones that are most natural to the causal set, because they respect the causal ordering.
Also, the field theory gives you the commutator to field operators zero, specialized surfaces. That's called microcausality, which is what you're supposed to have.
Yes. So if you just wanted the capital delta function, that would be easy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So because the Feynman propagator is non-zero for space-like separated points, that seems like quite a difficult thing to get on the causal set.
That's what you need.
Well, he's asking whether we can do it another way. Just because every textbook does something and writes what the last textbook writer wrote.
Okay.
Yeah, the textbooks.
Mean that they couldn't have taken another. They had no motivation to do it.
So do the following: take the causal Green's function, and calculate a cross section for proton-photon scattering.
And see if you get the right answer. Yeah. Yeah.
It takes 3 pages. 4. That's the answer.
Right. Okay.
If you don't, you don't. If you do, fine. Find out. Find out the answer is no.
Well, that's a little bit too naive. I mean, you're saying, look at every step in the calculation, and wherever you saw a Feynman propagator, put it in a causal propagator. That's not the only. The question is, could you? That might not work. But you. The real question is, could you rearrange the perturbation series so that you only needed to refer to the causal propagator? That's really the question.
Quantum field theory is an ancient thought.
Right.
It's very hard to change after 70 years or 60 years. Feynman published his paper, my training published paper in 1947, 48. I don't know. I'm just asking questions.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't you, for example, think of changing the definition of the adjacent matrix and thing on the
I mean, I was thinking like, these adjacency matrices you choose so are different. That seems really to be connected as you have read out the propagation. Only
Bj.
I mean,
you
choose a particular relation.
Yeah. So.
What if it's they go to the opposite one?
Like
minus one.
Oh, I see. So have.
So to make it symmetric, but not
symmetric. Yeah. Right. So if you carried this over wholesale and made these symmetric, then you'd be putting a one whenever two. Whenever the pair of points was related one way or the other. And then when you take powers of this, that would be summing over paths that go forwards in time, and then maybe backwards in time, forwards in time. But I think if you do that, then this K is no longer well defined because it diverges. You have paths that circle around an arbitrarily large number of times. And so then you. I mean, maybe it would be well defined, but you'd have issues of whether it converges. And maybe it would, maybe it wouldn't.
Isn't that the way to define the green?
Yeah, so. Yeah.
I think it's a natural suggestion. Mm-hmm. So you could allow paths that reverse their direction, and then you'd have, instead of just A, B, there'd be a C also, which would be the. A stop that included a reversal instead of a stop that didn't include a reversal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Could
yeah.
Could you choose that C in such a way as to get a Feynman propagation?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
That's certainly an option. But as Stevens, there's also an issue with convergence. This is cleaner, but this is the simplest thing you could have. It's already somehow surprising that you can write down such a simple expression that reproduces exactly the retarding propagation.
Yeah, so this comment I made before about whether the Fourier transform is most simple or the position space is most simple. It's possible that this simple path integral is underlying these seemingly complicated expressions.
I mean, something that sort of underlines why it's not so trivial is that you don't know an example in, say, 2 plus 1 dimensions, or
right.
9 plus 1 dimensions, or something that will do the same thing. So it looks like some miracle is happening.
Yeah. I don't know. In Wolfsburg, for example, in gauge theory, the Kuhn and other people have worked with a non-physical singularity in the axial gauge, for example, and they show that the this singularity having an extension imaginary part can not destroy, for example, the unitarity. And this, you know, this kind, perhaps this is a more kind of general term that can be shown.
Who did this?
Kuhn, for example. Axial gauge, depending the propagator for the axial gauge, will have a non-physical singularity.
Yeah, I was going to ask about question, because beginning of your talk you said you do all this causal set theory to potentially remove divergences and similarities in black holes and red holes. But here you reproduce the same properties, so you get the same diseases.
Well, no, not quite. So this, you on your causal set, because it's discrete, you can only fit in so many Feynman diagrams. You can't have particle emission and absorption on arbitrarily small scales. There's a Lorentz invariant cutoff by the discreteness. So this, the causal set version of QFT would be, well, you'd expect it to be more finite than the continuum case, and possibly finite straight off.
Then, very careful, because if you don't get one profit, minus one, you get something else also that you destroy your entirety. What you have to get in the numerator is stripping the entire function. Entire function is no pause in the complex piece code. And then you have other problems that we won't get. It's extremely tight.
To avoid the divergence.
Very you can do. So I feel very complicated to get rid of the so-called problems.
Or maybe you need something as radical as saying that space-time is discrete.
Is what?
Maybe you need something as radical as saying space-time is discrete.
Yeah, but the discreteness has to give rise to a completely consistent quantum.
Right.
So you don't need to be careful. It doesn't have to be completely consistent. We don't, because the only completely consistent theory has to be the one where you have quantum gravity as well. In other words, where you do the quantum theory of the causal statics. It has to be very approximately consistent.
But the first step is to get quantum field theory, which is unitary engaging around quantum theory and finite to all orders. This is what I want.
QCD is, or any asymptotically free theory, or any asymptotically safe theory, it's understood what to do with the alpha-violet divergences in a completely consistent and rigorous manner. So
yeah, but there's only one completely consistent point of truth theory, Shannon-Hall's theory, pure Yang-Hall's. And even that isn't totally consistent. It's not completely summable.
And that's the point.
Or else some of
them. But I mean, there's more to it than preservation.
But particle physics is not described by purely Yang-Hall's theory.
Sure.
No, particle physics is described by a not completely consistent theory. The standard model, as far as people know or suspect, is that all the evidence points to the standard model not being completely consistent. In other words, it has no well-defined continuum limit. But the problems are thought to be far enough out that they don't affect them. And that's what they're beyond the quantum regime in which quantum gravity should become important. So that's what I'm saying. You don't need to have a completely consistent quantum theory. You just need to have it consistent enough so that it doesn't clash with anything that would be has been observed already. I mean, ideally, you would hope, I mean, the best of all possible worlds, and suppose there's some residual non-unitarity here. The best would be that you see it in LHC. The best would be that, you know, that it's not too far away from anything that's been ruled out.
The only thing, from my personal experience, that can be given up, you have to give up something. It's locality and the root parts.
Locality is not
going to find that theory. And because it's only in the root parts, you can show that it's sufficiently causal to not cause trouble. But this is string theory. String theory is a normal theory. But it's sufficiently causal not to be trouble. At least that's what he tells us. So, it's an interesting background, because if you can get sufficiently consistent theory, what a good thing is a very interesting.
Yeah, well, fingers crossed. Fingers crossed.
Yes. Well, I think it's 4:30.